Hello, listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of The Cult Vault. I'm your speaker, Casey, and as you might be able to hear, I am slightly under the weather. We've had a nasty illness sweep through our household over the last 2 weeks, and it's taken its toll on my podcast work more than anything. Of course, I'm also 8 months pregnant and ready to pop, so all I can do is apologise for the lack of conspiracy episodes coming out at the moment and attempt to make the content up when I'm feeling better. Although I cannot say for sure when that will be, despite the negative news, the podcast has just reached 100,000 downloads. That's an incredible milestone that each and every one of you has helped me to achieve. And today I have another insightful interview to bring to you all. Today's chat is with Athron, who has a different story to tell us, but one that is often spoken about on the show. The idea of a highly controlled situation inside the family home. Athron is also writing and creating music in Bali, and his work is amazing. I've included a link to his newest album in the show description for anyone who would like to go and check this out. But for now, here is Athron. Hello, Athron, and thank you so much for joining me today. This is my first interview with someone over in Bali, which is really exciting. And today we are going to be discussing coercive control in a family environment as opposed to in a big movement environment. And this particular family environment uses religion to justify the means of this coercive control. So would you like to start by introducing yourself to our listeners?
Hey, listeners. My name's Athron. I grew up in the Blue Mountains of Sydney. And yeah, I'm discussing my childhood and my feelings around the whole idea of what it meant to grow up in a very indoctrinated, I'll say, environment as far as spiritual, charismatic Christianity goes. And the results of that sort of coming out of it into adulthood. Yeah.
And how do you find yourself in Bali today?
Yeah, I love just adventure and living off the cusp and just jumping on an opportunity. So I used to travel here a lot, and then I eventually got offered a job as editor for a magazine here and just took it on a whim, and then sort of forged my music live performance career here and based myself here. And I've been here for the last 11 years.
We were just talking before we hit the record button about how COVID has affected sort of musicians around the world. And you've just mentioned that you've moved from one part to another because the work has dried up a little bit during this time. So we find ourselves with plenty of a free time to sit down and have these nice lengthy conversations.
Like incredible lengthy conversations and then incredible amounts of time to go introspectively into yourself and think about what they all mean.
Yeah, so absolutely. Absolutely.
The whole world's in that frame of mind.
So you mentioned that you grew up in Sydney. Was it with your parents and siblings?
Yeah, it was with my mother. It was a single mother and one sister who's 4 years younger than I. Yeah.
Okay. And you mentioned that there was Christianity involved in your upbringing. What church were you officially affiliated with?
It's a funny one because I guess in the beginning we were very affiliated with Pentecostal, charismatic, born again Christian churches. We, over the course of my childhood, part of the sort of interesting transformation of going very insular into a family unit and my mother sort of being the head of that family church, I guess, is that we moved through churches constantly. So, and a lot of that was because of the way my mother was and her beliefs. And her beliefs were quite jarring to a lot of people around her. So yeah, we were deeply involved in those full-on Christian spiritual churches, which pushed her into a certain way of thinking. And then her thinking became so extreme that then we started to have to move away from churches altogether because we weren't accepted in churches anymore. She rubbed a lot of people up the wrong way and we got kicked out of a lot of churches and we had to keep moving around to get away from that. She ended up being, I guess she would say she was persecuted a lot. And I would say she often put herself in situations that ruffled a lot of feathers.
Right. But you continued despite not having sort of
at times an official church to be a part of, you continued with those Orthodox Christianity practices in the home.
Yeah, words like Orthodox, and it's funny because it was such a, I always use the word spiritual because, I mean, it was all Christian based, but it was like, it never felt, my mum was like, she always said, oh, I hate the word religion. I hate the word religion, because she was just so, it was such a personal thing for her, but she was so incredibly bound up in this spiritual side of Christianity that I never felt like we did anything in a kind of formatted religious way. I just feel like it was just everything we did was through the eyes of her belief system. So I don't know if that makes sense, but
yeah, I think it does. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the Pentecostalism as well, and I know that there's a lot of, you know, this of the spirit work that goes into Pentecostalism as well. So it would kind of align, I suppose, that in the sense of your mum feeling more of a spiritual Christianity being than a sort of reading the verses. And I mean did she things like grace before dinner and things like that?
Oh yeah definitely those sorts of things. Yeah, and I guess within the home there was lots of things that we did, you know, constantly do and kept up, like you know, every morning before school I would have to literally physically put on the armor of God, like and act it out to protect myself from demonic attack throughout the day, so that I was safe when I left the home. So there were certain things that were constantly going on that I guess were repetitive. Yeah, and actually, like, she grew up as a Catholic, and she became born again and filled with the Holy Spirit and had this whole new lease on what that meant. When I was born in Manhattan in the US, and at 6 months old, she brought me back to Australia. And it was just as she got back to Australia that she had this incredible experience where she became a born again Christian. And so I think all those things that she grew up with, which were very religious, religious, the mass sort of situation that you were talking about before, like reading the Bible verses and following the rules. And she, I guess she sort of found a way of rejecting those institutions, and she was also abused by a Catholic priest and all that kind of stuff. So she, I guess she had a lot that she was pushing away from when it came to that really religious, stale idea of your relationship with God. And then becoming a born again Christian was like everything to her, because it was a new relationship with God that was so deeply personal. So that's where she...
You've just given me a little bit of background there into the next question I was going to ask, which was about sort of how your mother came to find this type of religion before you were born. So she already held these beliefs and values when you came into the world.
Yeah, I guess she definitely held the values, and I guess she never lost complete belief. I know that she traveled the world for about 12 years before having me. She lived in New York for a long time. She would deny ever getting up to any mischief or anything like that, but she's got an incredible way of redefining her past and her existence and sort of changing the story all the time. So I often think she probably had a really wild, fun 12 years when she was traveling, and maybe that becoming a born again Christian, she decided to rewrite that history.
Right.
You know, and I would love to hear about those wild times and high five her, but I think she's just too busy redefining her whole existence based on her newfound existence, which began when she became born again, a born again Christian.
Right. Okay. So would you describe your mum as a devout follower of religion?
Oh, I mean, 1,000,000% devout, in terms of just absolutely lived and breathed everything to do with the idea that that it was all very real. I mean, there was absolutely zero possibility that it wasn't all completely 100% real. To the point of growing up, especially in the early years of development, there was no concept in my mind that there was anything outside of that, that there was, that there was any possibility that there was any untruth to it, that it should ever be checked or looked at through a different lens or anything like that. So yeah, there was no doubt in her mind whatsoever. Everything she did was with the 100% conviction that it was real.
Okay. Okay. And did that lead to you being homeschooled, or were you able to access public school?
No, she put me, myself and my sister through into a Christian school. So okay. Yeah. So it was coming from that. It came from school as well.
So there was no opportunity for you to interact with people that were experiencing potentially different cultural upbringings or different walks of life?
I think when I first did experience that, it was probably around the age of 13 when people from when I flipped from middle school into high school, and it was all at one school, went all the way through. But at once it hit to year 7 in Australia, a lot of the class doubled, and all these kids came in from public schools that had been on the waiting list to get into the Christian school. And a lot of those kids were pretty, you know, had different sets of values and different ideas and all that kind of stuff. So, and it's this real juxtaposition here, but like my mother really lived outside of the box in terms of a lot of people. So that caused me to want to live outside of the box a bit. So I was quite attracted to being friends with people that weren't of the normal way of thinking, but it didn't undermine my complete belief in Christianity. So therefore I ended up forming friendships with other kids that weren't necessarily good Christians. And that posed a challenge to my mother, because she then had me with friends that weren't Christians, which she then used as an opportunity to, I guess, minister to them and try and convince them of becoming Christians, because I guess it concerned her a lot.
Right. Okay. So there would be opportunities for your mum, if you ever brought your friends round for like dinner or to play after school and things like that, for her to kind of witness to them.
Yeah. And witnessing was pretty intense. I mean, so my mother believed she was a prophet of the end times, like in a huge way. Like, she's, just to give you a bit of a understanding of her, she, and a lot of this I realize in retrospect as an adult looking back, I mean, she was abused as a young child. She was of that era that never had the opportunity to truly talk about that and mm-hmm. understand it and get counseling. So she was an emotionally broken woman deep down inside. And I believe that at the core of it, she was just a child, you know, she was just a child that it had to be an adult, and which is really sad. So I think I've lost my train of thought, but I guess because of that, she had this way about her that a lot of kids really, a lot of my friends loved coming to my house because she was like a big kid. But then in the same sense, she would suddenly go from being everyone's best mate, like the best mate of the kids, to then like bringing into these really awkward moments of ministering to these kids or trying to convince them that Christianity was real. And I mean like intense stuff, like sitting my friends down at the table and telling them all that she had had a prophecy from God and visions of all their gravestones at the age of 18, and that they would all be dead if they didn't convert to Christianity and wow. give their lives to Jesus and things like that. So I'd be sitting there caught in this kind of weird thing of like, oh man, I just want to play with my friends. And I would be stuck with like, I believe what she's saying is true, but I feel very awkward that she's telling them, because obviously that's not the best. It's not a fun moment to be in the middle of.
Yeah. I mean, especially as a child that's susceptible or influential to ideas and thoughts. I've spoken to a few ex-Pentecostals who have talked about being terrified growing up, that, you know, one person spoke about how they went to church, but their mother, their father didn't come with them, and he didn't really practice the religion, and he didn't really identify as a member of the Assembly of God. But the children would try and convert him because they were so worried about him. They'd have nightmares about him not being saved. And I think that's really interesting, because you're like, I'm a kid and I want to have fun. But on the flip side, you're like, please don't scare my friends, because that sort of thing as a child is really scary.
Yeah, it is. And it's a lot of the things I sort of, as a kid, you know, within those first years up until age 10 or 11 or 12, you sort of, it doesn't matter how, you know, as long as there's no, and a good point to make is there was no sexual abuse or taking advantage of me coming from my mother. My mother was, I know she was doing everything out of a place of love and good intention, but it was it ended up being very twisted in terms of her emotional trauma and her relationship with me in the sense that I would swing from a counselor to a husband to a son and all these different things in a matter of hours. But in that, I think in any situation where there's no abuse, it doesn't really matter how wild the beliefs are up until the age of about 11 or so. If that's all you believe is the truth, it's all good. Like, you're living in this bubble. Like, you think that's the bubble is the whole world and that's how the universe operates, because it's all you've ever known since the day you'd learned to talk and walk. And
absolutely, yeah.
So it wasn't until, sort of just hitting those teenage years that where just other influences start to come into play, that you start to have that inner battle of noticing how extreme her beliefs are compared to everyone else's beliefs. And that whole weird bridge where you're like defending her beliefs all the time because it's 100% true, right? And constantly fighting with people about why they would ever doubt your mother's beliefs or doubt your beliefs. And then having to slowly over years get to a point where you start to realize that maybe all the things that other people have some basis. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it sounds as though the horrible things that your mum experienced when she was younger, she's almost living a second reality so that she doesn't have to live in the reality of the one where, you know, she's a victim of abuse and horrible things that happen to her by people in positions of power, which we talk about occasionally on this show, you know, people exploiting their status. It sounds quite similar to there's a movement called Love Has Won, which is quite active at the moment and highly regarded as a cult. And the leader of Love Has Won, her name is Amy, and she's very unwell from what people can ascertain from photos and videos that she puts up daily of herself. And she was severely abused by somebody in a movement she was a part of when she was growing up. Right. And now she is the leader of this movement, Love Has Won. And she is here to save the world, and she's going to transport all of the vessels to another plane. And she has some really strange and bizarre theories and ideologies and beliefs. And I covered this on another episode, and we were just speculating on whether she's created this reality and persona for herself so that she doesn't have to kind of confront the abuse that happened to her many years ago. And not only that, but Amy gets to be the center of everything, and she gets to be number one, and she gets to be the person that holds all the power and the person that is looked up to and is very special and important by putting herself as the figurehead of this movement. So I don't know if that sounds similar to kind of how
incredibly similar. I really do think that a huge part of it is finding a purpose, not because you feel like you're, you know, as a abused victim, I guess you had your hopes and your feeling of purpose and importance and all that kind of stuff dashed and like just stripped away from you, that when you felt like your innocence was taken, and you've probably struggled with, you probably felt so much shame, and what a shame to it. It makes you feel insecure and less important, right? And this is a way of turning all that around and not just becoming level and balanced, but going in the other direction and becoming literally an absolute necessity to save the world. If the mm-hmm. world, you know, your place in it. And a huge part of my mother's whole journey was about literally, she was at the forefront of breaking the power of Satan over Israel and breaking the demonic layers around the earth to allow Jesus to return. And she was sort of like, and you know, the prophet of the end times, the apocalypse. And she really sort of, she talked, now that I'm older and I've heard so many conspiracy theories over the years, she talked very much like those hardcore conspiracy theorists that take little bits of information and join it all together to create their own story, as if the whole world was just 10 people in a room and not a huge world with billions of people all with different motives and different objectives and different ways of thinking. Mum really thought that she was at the forefront of breaking the power of Satan over the world and leading God Jesus to return. And she even, you know, as she got more into that and more of those beliefs and more into her own world, she formed a group actually with a bunch of other women that were very much just like her, women that had been hurt and abused and outcast. When I look back at all their backgrounds, and they would form, I remember she would go off to these nights with these women and come back just speaking absolute wild stories about all the spiritual things that had gone on and the new missions they had and things she could say and couldn't say because Satan had planted demons around to listen, to spy on her. And very almost manic depressive kind of, you know, beautiful mind kind of theories and beliefs that, yeah.
And is your sister, is she older or younger than you?
She's 4 years younger.
Okay, so it sounds to me like you had sort of, so your mum is your primary caregiver, but it's almost like the roles are reversed in the sense that you have all this extra responsibility and probably a bit of responsibility of caring for your younger sister as well.
Yeah, it's a tough one because it was the classic case. It's that just enough age gap to sort of not be, not consider her my mate as I was a teenager because I just wanted to do my thing with my, you know, as at my age. And my younger sister, as much as my mother wanted her to, she was always like, take your sister with you. You know, it wasn't in my desire to do that. You know, it's the classic thing where you look back and go, oh man, I wish I'd spent more time with my sister and looked after her more. But I was just a kid. And so I don't remember really having an overwhelming sense of needing to care for my sister, which sounds terrible, but just as a kid, I remember very distinctly the tug of war of the relationship I had with my mother. But my sister was very much sort of under my mum's wing, and she was a bit quieter, and I was the man of the house. So mum put a lot on me regarding all this Christian stuff. I was very much convinced that I was to play a very pinnacle role in saving the world as I was growing up, and she was training me for that. So even when I left home when I was 17, which I believe a big part of that was just sort of getting out of the house and getting away. And my sister became even closer to my mum then. It was very concerning for a long time, actually, how they were almost like Siamese twins, you know.
Mm-hmm, 13 is a very delicate age, though, isn't it? If you kind of moved out at the age of 17, that would have left your sister at that age where most kids are starting to get thoughts and feelings about their sexual identification and kind of who they might have a little crush on or be attracted to or like spending time with, and also a very pinnacle point in expressing your individuality as a person. You know, you grow up as this little person with your little quirks and your little personality traits and stuff, but then as you reach the age of 13 and start to gain a little bit of that independence and kind of danger seeking, you know, where you stay out past curfew and things like that. And so 13 being in an isolated situation, I suppose, was the opposite for your sister. She kind of probably did the opposite of instead of going out and breaking the rules, she kind of probably just became more isolated with your mum.
Yeah, and a big part of me has always felt quite sad that I, you know, I was 17, so I obviously wasn't thinking that way, but I look back and I think, man, if I had stuck around and gone through my, you know, it took me till I was 21 before I realized, I had a real pinnacle moment of realizing that Christianity wasn't the truth. But but over those 4 years from 17 to 21, you know, I'm always saddened to think that I wasn't close to my sister talking her through those changes that I went through, because it may have helped her, like you said, had a balance. And a big part of all this is, you know, the fact that there's no balance when it's a small group of people, as small as two kids and one mother.
Yeah.
There's no one's checking anyone. Like if it's one leader and it's, the smaller the group, the less checked it is, right? The less people you've got to bring up their point of view or to bounce opinions around or whatever. So obviously once I left, it was just my mother giving her constant spiritual advice and critiques to Letha. So to my sister. So yeah, you're right. My sister, rather than rebel against it, she was very much drawn into it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, my mother took her out of school at one point and moved to the States on sort of a mission from God to save the world. It was all very bizarre, and even put my sister in some, I'd say some not very good situations, but at that, throughout that whole, by that time I had sort of cut myself off from my mother, which unfortunately cut myself off from my sister as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did you feel at that time that that was something that you needed to do in order to, like, almost like survival instinct kicking in?
Yeah, well, it was sort of a boiling point, I guess. As I said, I moved when I was 17, moved to the Gold Coast, which was 10 hours away. And then I'd come down on a holiday, actually, just to see my mother and my sister. And we'd been living in the same house for about, it was my Nana's house. My Nana owned the house, but we'd been living in this house for about, I guess, 14, 15 years. And when I went back down just to catch up with them, I was back down there for 2 weeks. And towards the end of the 2 weeks, my mother said, "Oh, by the way, I'm taking Talitha out of school and I'm taking her we're moving to the USA. I've got this mission. God's told me I've got to do it." Da, da, da. And it was crazy. Like she had a lot of debt. She had, you know, not much, like no money. She was a pensioner. So she had no money, a lot of debt. The house had been lived in for years and years. There was a garage. She was a bit of a hoarder, like a collector of sentimental things. So
mm-hmm.
huge backyard. And it was like the pinnacle of me going, "Oh my God, your mission from God is literally," like she basically just went, "And you've got to take care of everything. Like you're on a holiday here, but I'm leaving in 2 days, catching a flight. You've got to drive us to the airport. God told me I have to do it. And he told me that you have to look after everything when we leave." So I guess that just being left there, I'll never forget when she finally left at the airport, and it was with her crazy, a few of her crazy female spiritual group friends. And they're all just raving and speaking in tongues and going on this big tangent about the missions that they're on and stuff. And then mum leaves, and then I have to help this woman get home, and she's going on about all the incredible stuff they believe. And I'm just thinking, I have to drive back to a house. I live in another state 10 hours away, and I have to drive back. I was only 18 or 19 and deal with I don't even know what to do. Like deal with this house that she's just abandoned the whole country and dragged my sister off on this God mission. And I think it was just, that was it for me. I was so exhausted by this point of all the missions from God and the that we'd been dragged through. And at this point I was like, this is just now left me in a completely shitty situation. And there's a lot more to it in terms of the mental sort of connection and everything between my mum and I that was very hard to deal with at that point. But I just, when I left after cleaning up that house and dealing with it I went back up to Queensland, I was just like, I can't deal with this. I can't have contact for a while. Yeah.
And you mentioned that she said, you know, God told me that you have to do this, and was that something that you'd heard a lot by that point? That your mum had been told by God that you had these responsibilities to carry out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, throughout my whole life, my mother literally had God talking to her all the time, like directly, and it would either be very matter of factly, like, oh, God just told me this, or God just told me that, or God just told me that I should do this or that you should do that, or she would be anointed under the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, and you'd see her kind of shaking and receive, you know, having the Holy Spirit pour through her, and then she'd start sort of praying and speaking in tongues and then start saying things that God was saying through her. Or so it was very normal for, like, her decisions and her authority was very much coming from God.
Right. Yeah. And do you think that every time she used that sentence, like, God told me that you must do this, do you think that she had authentically received that instruction in her mind? Or do you think that she'd become so accustomed to getting you to do things that way that she would just say, well, God said you have to do it?
Yeah, there's a gray area there in terms of, I've always struggled with, because my mum ended up being very emotionally manipulative in a lot of ways. I mean, she's a survivor. So, and she was so caught up with that Christian belief that sometimes I look back and I go, man, there are areas where I'm like, did she know? Did she know that she was using it for her own advantage? Or did she truly think? It's really hard to define the line between what she knew she was getting away with and what she truly believed was coming from God. But and it shocked me that she couldn't see it, because even over the course of a week, a story she would tell would change 180 degrees. In terms of every time she told it would be manipulated a bit more to fit what she needed to get or what she needed to do. And I'd sometimes be thinking, have you not noticed that your story's changed? But it was very hard to know if she did know, mm-hmm. Because she was so caught up in it. And she was so, she got to a point where, like, I think any emotion she felt, she believed was either of Satan or of God.
Right.
So, like, if we were watching television and something came on that looked slightly scary or ghoulish or whatever, if you're supposed to get scared, like, but as soon as she felt that fear of seeing something a little bit evil on television, that to her meant that the doorway was opened for demons coming into the house, and she could feel it. She could feel that demons were coming into the house, which, of course, that taught me to believe that those feelings meant demons were in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Those, she very much, it's kind of like the whole, you know, Yoda teaching Luke to just feel the force. Like, my mum very much taught me growing up to learn how to feel the Holy Spirit within me, because she believed that the Holy Spirit's inside you and that it reacts to things that are either demonic or of God. And if you feel that, if you listen to the Holy Spirit, it will tell you whether something is demonic or not. So what that did was create this sense that if I felt like something was slightly wrong or scary, well, that was the Holy Spirit telling me it was demonic. And that was an evil thing coming into my life or in my room or whatever.
You've mentioned a little bit about these things that I would like to talk about next. I'm dipping in and out of the timeline at different points, because everything you're saying is so interesting. But before you reach the age where you move up schools and you're introduced to people that have had sort of experiences outside of what you are used to, what's your average day and week look like, sort of at home, maybe going to one church but then not going to that church and then finding a new church and then kind of every meal with your mum, bedtime, waking up. I'm just really interested to know what the structure of your day was like, and then sort of if there are any special moments that would happen throughout the week in terms of like Sunday mass and things like that.
Yeah, I guess in a lot of ways, I still look at a lot of my childhood as very normal in terms of my mother just doing fun stuff or just living life. Like it wasn't, I don't remember like each, you know, a regular thing that my mother specifically did that was like, oh my God, she did that every week. But there was a lot of normal life going on, you know, school and friends and holiday, like camping and things like that. But it was always infused with that tone. And then out of that, things would start to develop that would happen quite a lot for me. Like I suffered a lot from, I don't know, I guess I'm getting off the tangent here, but yeah, like something that happened that I remember regularly to me was I had a lot of night terrors, or at the time I thought I was being attacked by demons a lot. So I feel like I lived almost two parallel lives at the same time. One was like this normal, go to school, have friends, crushes, mm-hmm. Normal rebellion against authority, all those kinds of normal sorts of kid stuff. The love of the hanging out in the bush and playing with other kids, all that stuff. And on the flip side, I was so, I believed everything that my mother taught me about this demonic warfare. And I was constantly being taught that I was a huge part of that. And then that developed into a lot of scary stuff for me, which is like, you know, for a long period there, I felt like a few times a week at least, I was having these like incredible demonic attacks at night and all this kind of stuff. So I feel like when you asked me about like what the general week was like, a lot of it was really normal. But then on the flip side, I feel like I was always had this part in me that was like, can I even tell everyone all the other stuff that's going through my head all the time? Because it would just be, it wasn't ritualistic, but there would, everything was laced with that idea that mum was a prophet. And every time we dealt with a normal situation, that was part of it. You know, like if I got in trouble for something, then it wouldn't just be a normal process of dealing with the situation. I mean, mum might say, well, you have to let me know who gave you that thing, because God will tell me anyway. So if you don't tell me,
right,
then God's going to tell me anyway. So I'm still going to know either way, but you're going to get in more trouble if you don't tell me, because you know what I mean? And so there was just this constant, I was just like, oh, how can I fight against God?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I did have some questions about the sleep disturbances and stuff you experienced growing up. Was this common occurrences? You would have these nightmares about demons and sort of unsettled sleep, or was it just something that happened every now and then?
Oh, it was really common. Yeah. It was a huge part of my life for a long time, a very long time. And, I've always really struggled with understanding exactly what it was. I mean, I can only describe it as, from a scientific point of view, I guess, I can only describe it as like probably the worst form of night terrors. And it was happening like a few times a week for a long time. In fact, you know, even later on in life, when my mother would question, you know, when I was on good terms with my mum again, but she would bring up Christianity and she'd question how I could not be a believer in it anymore. She would often say, how can you possibly doubt it? You used to get attacked by demons throughout the week constantly. And I would come in and see you getting attacked by demons and have to pray. And we'd be up all night, you know, casting the demons out. And how can you not, how is that not proof to you? So at the time, of course, I, as a kid, yeah, it was happening a lot. I'll still never understand why that that happened so often.
Right.
But unfortunately, because it was happening often, all it did was confirm everything my mum said, that there was a spiritual warfare going on, and that I certainly didn't question what it was. I knew 100% it was demons being sent from Satan to attack me. And then, you know, then of course it would be, there'd be things like, well, you must have sinned, or you've brought something into your room that is not of God, and you need to think about what that could be. And
yeah, I was then going to ask if you would, you know, say to your mum, you know, last night this happened, and then she would kind of have a reaction to that of some type.
Yeah, she didn't always put it down to my fault. She didn't play that card, but she said it enough times that it obviously made, it didn't matter if she said it anymore after that. I remember she, you know, at one point I had to burn my Nirvana CDs and other things that I had in my, I had to look around my room and try and find what was in my room that was bringing demons into my room. And, you know, there was a, remember at one point there was like a little, really nice little wooden carving, it's kind of in the shape of a Buddha sort of thing. It wasn't religious at all, but, you know, remember mum saying, oh, you ask Jesus if that's, maybe that's come from somewhere, or that's a significant thing for a religion not of God, and maybe it's Satan's, you know, maybe Satan's coming in through that or whatever. And I had to pray and hold it in my hand and let the Holy Spirit tell me if it was evil or not. And then I felt that it was evil. So then we had this whole thing of burning it and praying and casting the demons away from it and all that kind of stuff. So obviously, having those, it did, yeah, anytime I had went through those attacks, I mean, they were horrific. Like I wouldn't sleep all night, and I'd go to school, and that's where I'd be like living two lives, because I couldn't tell my friends about it. I tried that once, and it was just, you know, you can imagine the reaction from kid to school telling him you were up all night getting attacked by demons.
Yeah. Well, even, you know, I think that's why so many people listen to these interviews, you know, not just survivors and victims of these types of high controlling situations, but people that are just curious about cult-like methods of control and how somebody could be indoctrinated or how somebody could undergo thought reform. And then you listen to people's stories and it starts to make sense to them. But even as adults, we're so curious about it because we don't understand it. And then as a child, to go to your friends and say, like, listen, guys, there's something I need to tell you. I'm really tired today because I didn't sleep. Not because I was up playing video games all night, but because I was up trying to cast a demon out of my body or my room or my house. So it's, you know, and children can be quite malicious and mean with things that they don't understand, or they'll just kind of go cool because they don't know how, they don't have the capacity to react in any other way, you know. Or they could go home and say, you know, oh, Athron didn't sleep last night because he was casting demons out of his bedroom. And then the parents are kind of like, well, I don't know if that's somebody that you should be spending your time with, because the parents don't understand it. And then it's that big long cycle of people who aren't sure how to react to the situation will often have the reactions that are not comforting to the person experiencing these things in the middle. But you mentioned early on about waking up every morning and physically putting armor on. So this was a daily part of your routine.
I remember that happened. Yeah, that was a pretty big part of the routine for quite some time.
What was the armor? Where did it come from?
Oh no, it was like it was imaginary. Like, as in,
oh,
mum would basically we'd pray, and then she'd say, you need to put on the spiritual armor of God to protect yourself. And it wasn't like, you know, I wasn't actually dressing up in, which would be pretty full on. That would be a point of getting teased at school. But she would talk us through, I mean, she believed it was real, but you couldn't see it. And it was her way of convincing, you know, showing us that, like, you have to armor yourself with the armor of God to protect yourself, because, you know, all day we live in a spiritual world that's Satan versus God, and you need to keep yourself in check and make sure you're wearing that spiritual armor to protect yourself from any attack.
Is something your sister was encouraged to do alongside you as well before she would go to school?
Yeah, from memory it was both of us. It's funny though, like, I don't remember that as a, I guess that was just a representative thing of the whole belief system. It, I mean, you know, that in itself could have just been a, when someone believes something that much, like, that's kind of just like a, it could have just been a cute thing to do with your kids before they go to school, to sort of remind them of the importance of all the stuff that she'd been teaching us. I never looked at that as a really, as a bad thing. It just sort of, I thought, isn't that cute that you made us put on the armor of God, you know? But it's more representative of the entire picture of her beliefs, that there was a complete spiritual warfare going on all the time, and it just sort of constantly cemented in my mind that we weren't just living in a physical world, and that I had to constantly be aware of that.
Yeah. I just thought it was something interesting to go back on, because it's not something that I have ever heard of in somebody's kind of routine. I didn't attend church or have any sort of religious influences particularly growing up. In primary school, we were encouraged to sing hymns in assembly, but that's as far as my affiliation with religion ever came when I was growing up. I wasn't in an area that was heavily influenced by any religion. I wasn't friends with anybody who was particularly religious. So I always find it really interesting when I hear about things like, you know, representing the armor of Jesus by putting it on in the morning and things like that. So for anybody else kind of in the same boat as me that might be listening, I just wanted to kind of go back to that and explore it a little bit more. And it's interesting that you say it's not, well, yeah, it's not really a big deal, you know, it's not really something I remember too much. Because if somebody asked me to do that today, I think I'd be like thinking about it in like years to come. Like, remember that day when that person like encouraged me to put my armor on? but at the same time, you could see it being something used in therapy as well to protect you from things that, you know, like if you suffer with social anxiety, you could see it as some kind of potential exercise that somebody might encourage you to use when you're out and about and feeling, you know, particularly vulnerable or triggered or anything like that. So I find all of this stuff really, really fascinating and interesting. But the thing that it was particularly upsetting in what you said before was having to, you know, throw out or burn particular items of sentimentality to you when you mentioned that your mum kind of hoarded things and kept things that were sentimental to her. So was a lot of this stuff religious propaganda that would be around the house, sort of books and trinkets and things that were that had good vibes and not things like a Nirvana CD that might be seen as demonic?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, she was when I say she was a sentimental hoarder, I guess it was just sort of all life stuff, you know, over the years of collecting things and whatever it was. But certainly there was a Mum was really aware of anything that came into the house that wasn't of God. And I remember just recently talking to my oldest cousin. I've got a lot of cousins, and my oldest cousin, who was obviously, I think 15 years, or maybe 10 years older than me. He was telling me the other day how once when I guess I must have been, 15, he was probably 25 or something. Maybe he was a bit older, but he was telling me how he actually challenged my mother, because he very much wasn't a Christian, and he was at the house, and he told me, I remember challenging your mum once on on her having only Christian doctrine and paraphernalia and education whatsoever in the house. And I'd said to her, Kath, this is not good. This is not going to give Athron and your daughter a reasonable understanding of how the world operates, and it's not going to allow them to be prepared for the greater world when they leave it. And he said, you know, her reaction was just very strongly that it will do nothing but prepare them for the real world, that it will prepare them for how things really are, and that he just didn't understand how the real world operated because it was a spiritual world that she was much more in tune with.
Would she ever go as far as to accuse your cousin then of being not of God if he's willing to come into your house and challenge her on her beliefs?
She had a very it's a funny one because there's a real mishmash of her religion and then her emotional issues with this stuff. She really even though she was abused by men, and that's where a lot of trauma, childhood trauma came from, she also kind of put men on a pedestal in terms of she probably challenged her a lot when he did that, because I remember whenever he would come around, she'd be like, oh, Brennan T, you know, show the man of the house, the man, some respect. You know, I think because she lived as a single sort of emotional mother, she's that always longed for that partnership. Probably she sort of, I just noticed she put men on a bit of a pedestal. So I didn't sense that she ever sort of blocked someone like a cousin coming in, and she had a lot of love for the family, but at the same time, she would constantly be reflecting to me and telling me stories about how the whole family persecuted her and thought she was crazy and thought she was and were always talking behind her back. And she sort of constantly had this battle with the rest of the world and the rest of the family that everyone thought she was strange and weird. And it's sad because at the end of the day, what chicken or the egg sort of thing, you know, like was her behavior probably did cause a lot of people talking about her outside of the room, but a lot of it probably wasn't just persecuting her for no reason. It was probably just discussion on how well she was and how extreme her beliefs were and whether they were damaging to the people around her.
If you've got lots of cousins, I'm guessing your mum must have brothers and sisters.
Yeah, she's got I think 5 brothers and sisters.
And Were they sort of heavily influenced by religion, or was it your mum who kind of through her experiences growing up kind of just took religion, held onto it, and kind of ran?
Most of them stuck with either Catholicism or became Christians, but nothing like the born again sort of. They were more Baptist church Christians that didn't. You know, is that kind of go to church on Sunday and just live an honest, fruitful life during the week. Mm-hmm. You know, that classic really good stock people who had great heart. You know, I loved my uncles and aunties. They were all amazing, truly mm-hmm. honest, beautiful people. And they all really, really worried about my mother because she was so extreme with her beliefs.
Yeah, I was gonna ask if, you know, that you ever sort of got a visit from any of them, kind of maybe just doing a little check-in to make sure that everything was okay.
Well, I think they were quite cautious. They never really talked to me in that sense, but I do remember that when the story that I told you about sort of going on the holiday down there and then mum suddenly telling me she was taking off to America with Talitha and pulling her out of school, when that started happening and when all the uncles and aunties realized what mum was doing, they even flew down, like some flew, I don't even know if mum even knows this to this day, but some of them flew down to Sydney and came down and they were having big family meetings just around the corner from my house at another uncle and auntie's house about this because it was so concerning, you know, that mum was just taking Talitha out of school at a young age and going overseas with no money and leaving debt and leaving my nana's house sort of abandoned and leave. And so they were sort of secretly getting me to go up to this house. And I just remember sitting like, you know, I was pretty young and a fucked up teenager, you know, like early adult sort of time in my life, just sort of sitting there looking at this long table with all my uncles and aunties, and they're all just sort of going, your mum's, she's really gone off the deep end here. You have to stop her. You have to stop her leaving the country. You know, you have to try and do something. So that was kind of, I guess, the most I realized they were willing to just talk to me straight up about how over the top she was.
Yeah.
Prior to that, I was still a teenager, so they probably were cautious as to what they would be able to say to me.
Yeah. And that's interesting as well, isn't it? That they kind of realize the difference between you as an adolescent and you as an adult, where they kind of start treating you with the same vocabulary and language and bringing issues to you that you are going to have to deal with now that you're an adult, you know? So at least there was that, you know, that they didn't continue to kind of shelter you from their thoughts and worries at that point. But yeah. you mentioned in some of your writing about having sort of severe arachnophobia, and you know, you would find spiders in the house, and your mum would kind of use that as a symbol to say that, you know, the demons are in the house or the devil's in the house.
Yeah, I mean, it's classic stuff when someone's so of that way of thinking. They just, I mean, she would, I don't think she ever realized how much you're affected by certain just comments. I mean, I have severe arachnophobia. I don't know what came first, the arachnophobia or whether I was more scared of spiders because of this, or whether I became more arachnophobic. I can't remember, but yeah, like I remember at one point, you know, we lived in the Blue Mountains. There's a lot of spiders in Australia. And there was a lot of these big huntsmans in my room over 2 days. I think I had like eight of these huge huntsmans in my room.
Oh my goodness. Oh no.
And I even just talking. And I remember my mother saying, well, they're attracted to evil. They're attracted to dark sin. And so you have to think about what you've been doing to cause them to want to come into your room. And, you know, I don't even know if she remembers saying that. I think to her it was an offhand comment.
Yeah, but to you it's like, oh, no, what? I can't have these keep coming into the house. What can I do to stop them?
Yeah, you just go into this inner turmoil of, well, what am I doing? Like, what am I doing that's bad that would allow that to happen to me? I was already struggling enough with the demons that were apparently crashing my room at night and wondering why the hell this was happening to me. So to have spiders in there as well for possibly the same reasons was pretty frustrating.
And then there was the story you mentioned about when you moved away and you got involved with a lady that you were deeply in love with, but the indoctrination or the thought reform that you'd experienced growing up kind of played on that relationship with that person.
Yeah, well, I think you're referring to the relationship. I went into a relationship when I left home and, you know, at 17 and moved to the Gold Coast. So I very quickly met a girl that I fell in love with, and I was with her for 4 years. But interestingly enough, she there's a lot looking back, I realized she was very similar to my mother in a lot of ways, and emotionally damaged. She'd been abused as a child as well. She actually, have you covered the Children of God cult?
I haven't, but I do know quite a bit about them. Yeah.
So her first few years were in that cult. Her mother and father were in that cult.
Right.
Her older sisters grew up within it more than she did. But yeah, she had a lot of trauma and all that kind of stuff. So she was very much like my mother in a lot of ways. But she was just like me in the sense that, like, rejected the normal sort of church sorts of things. But still at the crux of it was deeply believed that Christianity and Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit was all very real and the truth. And so she and I bonded and fell in love and formed a relationship both with those same beliefs. And but it was, yeah, so it was intrinsic to the core of our beliefs as a couple. We're very young, obviously, but But yeah, it definitely affected us. I mean, I remember I lost my virginity to her, and it was, instead of, you know, what should be a beautiful part of growing up, it was devastating, because I mean, we 100% believed, and I completely believed, that to have sex out of wedlock was basically giving your relationship to Satan, and that it was just pushing God completely out of your relationship and just opening the doorway for Satan to just come in and own your relationship. So yeah, I remember going through like weeks of anguish over, you know, because I was young, I was a young guy, and we were, you know, we'd fought off having sex for, I think, a year or so before we did have sex, and gave into the passion and the physical needs of a growing person. But you know, the moment after having sex, it was just this flood of guilt and shame, and oh my God, I felt like Judas, you know, I betrayed God. And I remember just having my own little ceremonies, like baptizing myself with water to try and just praying and trying to rid myself of and start again, you know. And then, of course, you've opened the doorway. It wasn't the only time we had sex, but every time we did, just the shame and the regret and the just this tug of war between what my physical body would give into and what my brain and heart would think was just the worst thing I could have done to myself.
And then, I mean, how do you baptize yourself then? Do you go like to the ocean, or do you do it at home with the bathtub? What does that look like?
Yeah, I guess, like, I mean, the relationship with God and Jesus that I'd been taught to have through my mother was very personal. It wasn't, as I said, we got kicked out of a lot of churches. We moved away from a lot of churches. And Mum was a direct prophetess of God who spoke to God personally constantly. So she very much taught me that the relationship with God was between me and God, was between us. So for me to baptize myself was just my way of, like, my own. I think I would just go and just get a bowl of water and sit in my room and like throw it over my own head and just be praying to God and just saying to him, I want to baptize myself. I can't remember exactly how I did it, but I did it in that kind of a way where it was like my own personal little ritual between me and Jesus, because I truly believe that he was watching and he would listen. And well, I hoped he would, you know, it was my way of proving to him how sorry I was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It seems so extreme that you felt like the only way to repent after, you know, experiencing something completely natural with another human being is to go and baptize yourself. Did your partner feel like she needed to do the same? Did you ever mention to her that that's what you'd gone and done?
I can't remember if I told her I did that, but we both definitely were both in regret. We both felt devastated. We both very much fought against having sex again.
But you know, being a human, being a growing teenager as well, just felt bad, but you didn't feel bad enough, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, how do you fight your physicality at that age? You've got chemicals running around your system like crazy. Yeah.
I thought another really sweet thing you mentioned in some of your writing was that there was another lady that you had a little crush on when you were a bit earlier, a bit younger. And you mentioned writing letters to her as well that your mum found out about.
Yeah, that was a crush. It was sort of my first crush on someone outside of, or in the secular world, I guess. It was the sister of my neighbor. So I met her and I ended up sneakily were sort of seeing each other. And I felt like it was a bit, I didn't really want Mum to meet her. I remember it was a bit naughty because she was not a Christian and she went to a public school and all this kind of stuff. But I was like, I remember I used to write notes and sneak out at night and go up to her house and slip them under her door. And one night I was about to go out and Mum sort of caught me, and I had a thing that I'd written, which was, I just sort of wrote this in like stylized writing. I wrote, I'll meet you on the dark side of the moon. It was just like it was just me trying to be poetic, basically. And mum read it and said, you do realize that the dark side of the moon is the side of the moon that Satan, where Satan operates, and he owns that part of the moon. And that's, it was this whole story that was just like, and again, it was like, you know, I can't even.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. You get the picture.
Everything that is outside of your mum's ideals is put down to something that can't be explored, can't be part of your kind of, you know, your narrative or personality, which seems like, listening to it makes me kind of feel like somebody has their hands around my throat, if that makes sense. Like, I feel like,
you know, it's funny you say that. Like, I always shy away, like I was sort of even felt a bit sort of shy from having this chat, because I think with anything like this, you're always in this weird thing of like, you feel like you're betraying someone that loves you. You feel like you're betraying, mm-hmm. like, I feel like I'm betraying my mother, you know, because in one sense, she was an incredibly loving woman who, as I said, had her own problems to deal with, but you feel like you're betraying someone with all that. But yeah, I often think about how I felt as a teenager. The older I got and the more I started to feel this oppressiveness that came with all these her, and it really felt, I used to describe it later in life, like I had hands around my throat, and it was something, yeah, it's interesting you say that. Like, even just recently in the last couple of years, I was sort of battling with that feeling again of like, just the hands around the throat where you're like, you can't get your own words out. You can't describe who you are in your own way, because there's constantly this awareness that something's there ready to choke it back. If it doesn't fit into the perspective of the way the world really is, this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. It just sounds very restrictive as well, in the sense that as soon as you start to explore or branch out, you know, growing up, as soon as you start to have these individual thoughts or ideas of your own, they get sort of, you know, you're not allowed to have them. They get covered. It's like somebody quickly putting the candle out, you know, they get burnt out before they have a chance to kind of flourish. And I think that's what I feel when I'm listening to your story, is that there's this, you know, there's this little spark and this little fire that starts, and then it's just kind of, it's put out before it has a chance to spread. And that's what I feel like the hands around the throats kind of thing is that's where it's coming from. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. you get it, you get the spark, and then it's gone again. And I can imagine it's really hard to relive and re-experience these things. But I often wonder how many people are listening who have had similar experiences that will be able to listen to your story and say, oh my goodness, this is exactly how I felt. And this is exactly, you know, what happened to me. And I always felt like I couldn't speak to anybody about it at school. And you know, and I went off and baptized myself and things like this. It would be interesting to see if there's any feedback or if anybody gets in
touch. It was a big part of sort of going, yeah, it would be good to have this chat. Like, as I said, I was a bit hesitant sort of as we were leading up to it. There were parts of me that were very hesitant, and mm-hmm. just that feeling of like, oh, do I really need to tell this negative story about, you know, about my mother? It felt a bit full on. But then I was like, well, it's still my story. And then I was sort of thinking about it with that perspective. I was like, well, I've listened to a lot of your discussions on cults, and
mm-hmm.
and one thing that really fascinated me about it was that often, even though they're incredibly intense situations, a lot of the cults that you discuss, like far more intense and brutal and physically and financially devastating to the people involved than what I experienced. But also because of that, a lot more, I guess, a smaller section of society has been in that situation.
Yep.
But what I also found was that even though they were taken from, you know, small moment sections of society that have been in that situation, I still related to a lot of the emotional thing journeys that the people would go on that you would interview. I was like, I still went through that, and I still remember feeling that way. And one huge battle I found was that because I didn't join a cult, or because I didn't have any background to fall back on after getting out of a cult, it was all I knew. It was this growth through childhood, completely indoctrinated by this belief system. And because it was with a mother that loved me so much and was doing her best intention, but everything was twisted through that spiritual lens, I feel like, yeah, there's got to be a lot of people that would relate to exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah, it really spun me out. I was kind of like, oh, I keep relating to all these things you're talking about, even though I wasn't in that extreme of a situation.
Yeah, I think it's relative though, isn't it? Because when I was speaking to Dr. Janja Lalic, she was saying that, you know, you can have a cult of two. You know, the same systems and practices can still be in place to create the same levels of coercion and thought reform. So there's probably people sitting there thinking, yeah, but there was only two of us or three of us or four of us in the house. So it wasn't like these, you know, churches and religions and movements and sects that have thousands and millions of followers all over the world. But that doesn't have to be the case for you to still be exposed and exploited in similar ways.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, even the coming out of it phase, the length of time it can take to come out of something, whether like sort of not, you know, the veracity of the situation, and might not really matter if it's a long-term, if it's been a long-term growth of the only thing you've ever known. I mean, it took me a good 10 years before I really didn't have the Jesus in the back of my head, sort of, the thing in the back of my head going, what if it's still real, you know, or just something, you know, they're going, well, what if, because I still suffered night terrors I still have them occasionally. They've lessened over the years, but right up through my 30s, I still had night terrors. So even those sorts of things were so scary when they happen, they're so scary, and it would bring back all those feelings and all that fear, and then that wave of, well, what if they're demons? What if it's still Satan attacking me, and I'm just getting further, you know? So it still takes a long time, I think, for anyone that's grown up with just looking at life through the lens of a religion. It takes a long time to be able to break away from it if you feel that you need to, and if you feel that you start to question it and realize that it's not necessarily the defining factor of truth that is the way the world operates.
The church that you did attend, where they carried out exorcisms and hands-on healing, and I just wanted to know what that looked like, because that sounds terrifying to me.
Yeah. A lot of the churches we went to had that sort of stuff happen. I mean, my mother was very attracted to, yeah, the churches that were very spiritual. And so a lot of the churches we went to were very much, you know, there was when I look back, there was a very defined sort of way that those churches operate. They start out with, you know, coming together, and then you start the service with some songs. And it's funny because it's always put down to like, this is the Holy Spirit moving in people. But if you think about what's going on here, it's a very tried and tested way of opening up people's emotional responses and making people feel unified and all that kind of stuff through music. So you'd come together, you'd sing some songs together, then the pastor would get up and do a sermon and teach everyone about, you know, how to live and how to operate, and then, you know, towards the end of the service, then the band would slowly come back up onto the stage. The drummer would get the mallet sticks and slowly ride that crash cymbal, that shh, and there would be this build up of the music, and then it would go into singing again and praying, and then the songs would get more and more extended, and then people would start praying in tongues, and then they'd start calling people up to the front for prayer, and then you'd have like the row of the church elders all with the pastor all lined up, and then people would all be coming up with their hands raised up towards the front with the just in this constant reaffirmation that the Holy Spirit is pouring through us now. The Holy Spirit is pouring through us, building up the music, emotions are running wild. And then of course people start going into states. So then there would be like the hands on healing. They'd be right. Anyone that has anything that needs healing, come to the front. And you might have a minister passing through town on a healing tour or something, you know, where they get moved from church to church as a visiting pastor, and they've got a healing ministry, and they're known for having huge healing sessions. So maybe everyone would go up the front for that. And then in those moments, you know, it all became very normal. That was a real normal part of the process of a day. That's a typical Sunday at church. And then in those moments, they could extend to like 2 hours or so of very extreme situations of either, the hands-on healing where people are being slain in the spirit, where people would be passing out all over the shop. And then you had moments where, like I remember once, demon exorcisms where people might start losing it, and it would be, right, it's a demon within someone trying to come out. So you'd have all the church elders run over and stand around and go through this. You know, I remember once a guy had come into the church, and he was sort of a rough looking biker kind of guy in his black leathers, obviously a deeply disturbed individual who'd obviously been through a lot. He looked, from memory, like he'd been through a lot. And I remember him going down the front, and then he just started losing it, and no joke, these deep guttural, like crazy voices started coming out. And then it was like all the church elder, all the guys ran over to sort of deal with it. And he was literally, it was like superhuman strength. He was like throwing guys, like everyone had to run to the back of the church. He was throwing guys through seats, down aisles, like 8 guys at once. Woof. And I remember all this green slime like coming out of his mouth, which is probably just saliva, but I still remember it vividly as being really green, like it just looked like something out of the movie The Exorcism. And so, you know, that kind of stuff, I mean, that wasn't happening all the time at every one of those things, but I saw that a few times in different situations. But those kinds of,
as a kid, intense, to see that sort of thing, that's scary.
Yeah, well, it just reaffirmed, you know. And with my attacks at night, you know, they were way scarier. Like, to me, I was just like, oh, at least it's happening to him this time. But yeah, like, it just reaffirmed that it was all real, that it was constantly going on, you know.
Well, I've got one last thing for us to discuss before I hand it over to you and ask if there's anything you think that we might have missed out. And that's to talk about the experience that you had with DNA testing when you wanted to figure out the truth about your father. And I just wondered, what did that journey look like and what did you discover?
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's a huge story and a huge journey. It's actually, it is very tied into all this though, in the sense that my mother told me the story about my father from a very early age. And it was a story very heavily laced in rejection and all that kind of stuff. She was in a relationship in America, in New York, and her boyfriend of a year had, when she fell pregnant, he rejected her and forced her to leave. And there's this whole horrible story about my father. And I grew up constantly being told this story, which, looking back, it was probably my mother trying to, I guess, put us as she did, like change the story and put a perspective on it, that where she was the victim again, and that to relieve herself of any shame of living a life of sin or whatever.
Yeah.
What she didn't realize that she was constantly telling me a story that my father rejected me. So I was constantly being told about this father that rejected me and this horrible story. But anyway, sort of flash forward years later, I was on a mission to find him and my brothers and sisters. I ended up finding a brother and a sister online when I was about 28 or 29, developed a relationship with them, spent 10 years building up this whole relationship with them. And then eventually wanted to go and visit them, went to the States, went and met them. He didn't really want to see me, but when I finally got there, he was open to it. And so I spent 3 days with them, had this incredible time on Long Island, getting to know them. And finally at the end, I was sort of thanking him that he'd finally accepted me into his life. And could he just finally look me in the eye and tell me that he was fine with me being his son and all this. And he looked me in the eye and said, "Well, I don't think you are my son." I was like, "What the fuck?" Yeah, and so that obviously led me after sort of getting through the shock of him saying it and going, "Mate, you don't have to do this. Like, I'm not worried about the past. I just want to move forward and be part of this family." And you know, anything that mom's told me about how you rejected me and us, it's okay. You don't feel bad. And he's like, no, I really don't think you're my son.
Oh my goodness. So he probably never even slept with your mom if he was so sure about it. He sounded like
he slept with her. Because his next thing, obviously I pushed him. I was like, "Well, you better tell me your side of the story." And it's funny because, you know, after all the years of me going through all the motions of getting to understand that my mother had so many stories that she built in her mind to create this world that we lived in, I never questioned the father story. Like, mm-hmm. I never did. It was just a factual story about where I came from.
Mm-hmm. Is this the same father as your sister as well?
No, it's not. It's not. Yeah, different father, similar sad situation, in fact, but different story. But yeah, so I'd never questioned that. And then this was this sudden slap that, like, oh my God, is that story not real as well? And, but to be honest, when he told me all that, I just still was convinced it was him that was lying. And so then I convinced him that we should get DNA tests. There was a long story to finally get the DNA test results. And I was in the States doing a music tour across the States, 2 months traveled across the States, finally got the results of the DNA test to my computer when I'm in San Diego, open it, just thinking, okay, I can finally show him and the family that he is my father. And it just said 100% not your father.
Oh my goodness, like, me. That's like a reality TV show, isn't it?
Yeah, it was huge. It was like, it was the, you know, when I realized that at the age of 21 that Christianity wasn't real, my whole world fell out from under me because I didn't have a basis of what everything was built on anymore. I had to rebuild that. And this was it sort of felt that way. It was like, oh my God, like it was like someone reaches into your brain and just every memory you have on how you built a story and a perspective on yourself as well. I mean, I build a whole perspective of myself based on this father. Yeah. And it's like, the matrix just shifted and it was all a different story. So, I mean, the beautiful, oh yeah. And I guess the connection with all that, with everything we've talked about in this catch up is it really does come back to my mother building a story based around what could allow her to operate and feel okay emotionally. And I think she just wanted to reject, because obviously at the end of the day, she was saying that it was my father. She also told me my father was cheating on her and all this kind of stuff. And at the end of the day, you know, it's a different story. She'd been obviously been seeing other guys and then she was, you know, good on her. She was like I said, high five. I even called her and said, "Mom, if you're a porn star in your early 30s, I'll give you a high five. Just tell me the true story." But yeah, she had built up such a she just fabricated this whole world and this whole story to, and obviously never thought that DNA results would be a thing. But to sort of give a sort of a up-to-date sort of part of that story, I spent the last 5 years searching for my true father, which is quite difficult. Hit a lot of dead ends, a lot of crazy, weird coincidences and bizarre shit that I'd uncover stuff and then just hit dead ends. And my mother only eventually opened up about two possibilities that it could be. And I chased all these journeys. And eventually last year, around July, I discovered who my real father was, which was just incredible to finally get there. And there was a lot of bizarre coincidences that had to fall into place for me to find out. But I found out, and unfortunately he passed away 4 years ago while I was looking.
No.
Yeah, which is obviously super sad, but but the beauty of what's come out of it is that he has three amazing kids and an ex-wife that is an absolute legend, and they have just been the most incredible people to come to know, and I feel like I've just been gifted the most incredible family.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, I've had the most incredible result, and I've kind of earned two families, to be honest, because even though the guy that said he wasn't my father was right, I developed an incredible relationship with those guys as well, and those kids anyway. I built up, they certainly felt like my family by the end of it. But it's all come to a beautiful place. It just saddens me that I can't even broach the subject with my mum really anymore.
Yeah,
and it saddens me because the reason behind that is that it's not really out of any, I can see it's not out of her being vindictive or having bad intention. She's just behind too many emotional walls to even deal with it.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think do you think your father had any idea that you'd been born?
Zero.
Oh, it's such a shame that you never got to meet him, but a huge shout out to his children because we know how awesome they are. So hi to you guys if you're listening. Super, absolutely. Super excited that Atheron managed to find you all. I think that's great. And there's so much sorrow and sadness and angst and anxiety kind of tied up in this whole story. And then at the end of it, it feels like, you know, when I speak to people and I speak to ex-Jehovah's Witnesses and they're like, yeah, I left and then I married my true love who was never a Jehovah's Witness. And now we celebrate every birthday, Christmas, Halloween, Thanksgiving, all the holidays that we're usually not celebrating. And there's like, you know, and I've been to therapy and there's some amazing stories that come out of people that leave these movements. So I feel like your kind of version of that is that you went off on your own, built your own life sort of without the domineering presence of your mother, and then realized that you had this whole other family to be a part of and make connections with. And I just think that's an incredible end to such a strange journey.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, I would never, there's certainly no part of me that wants to go back and change my past. You know, if I could go back and change anything, it would only be with the intention that it would change my mother's past and alleviate her from the years of sort of suffering and rejection and emotional trauma she went through. But you know, we all become who we are because of our past. And I certainly don't pine for a different past and a different upbringing, but I'm also aware of how long it took me to get out of that whole way of thinking. And I do really feel for people that are in those situations where they're still in the middle of that. And they're still in the middle of questioning how to view the world, and they can't understand how to separate their parents from God or their parents from their own decisions, their own desire to discover the world outside of possibly the religion that they're being indoctrinated with, because they think that they're both so tied together. So my heart goes out to people that are in that situation, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And where are your mum and sister now? Do you have regular contact with them? Has your mum ever kind of has there ever been any suggestion that your mum may have needed sort of any professional help at any point?
Yeah, sadly, I've always tried to get her to go that way, but she's always just said, "Jesus will heal me. Jesus will heal me." And huge mental breakdowns over the years and things like that. Her and my sister are still very close, and I'm very close to my sister, and they live right near each other. And my mother now, it's interesting. She's older. Her memory's going. She's a lot quieter, and just I think because her memory's going, because she's sort of getting old, she certainly doesn't speak up. So she's a lot easier for a lot of people to sort of hang out with in that sense. So she doesn't have those overtly intense ways about her anymore. Which is, you know, through sad circumstance because she's getting older and all that kind of stuff. But I've also I don't look at her as a dominating force that's trying to convince me to be a Christian anymore. That was a long time ago, and I just focus on having a good relationship with her just respecting her as a son and all that.
Awesome. Well, I think I've gone through all of my points. So unless you think there's anything we've missed, Athron, I think we've got to the end of our conversation today.
Yeah, great. No, it's been an interesting chat.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed listening to the ins and outs of your experience and kind of gathering a perspective on these types of experiences that aren't kind of what I'm used to listening to by this point. But we still went through Stephen Hassan's bite model, and you were still able to kind of apply experiences to almost every point in that model that applied to you throughout your childhood, which I just think goes to show anybody that's not sure about, you know, how many people need to be in a group for those cult-like methods of control to be put in place. I think this is a perfect example that just shows, you know, two, three, a very small number of people is all that's needed, with one kind of charismatic leader with strong beliefs and values to kind of enforce those ideologies and those beliefs and practices on the younger, more susceptible people that they're involved with. So I can't tell you how thankful I am for you taking time out of your day to come and speak with us and give us those insights and experiences that you've had, and to explain to us the situation that you grew up in and the difficulties around, you know, having a parent that has such strong convictions and beliefs around religion. So thank you so much, Athron, for giving me your time. I really appreciate it.
Great catching up with you.
So awesome. I'm going to end the call there, and I will catch up with you soon. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah, great. Cheers, Casey. Great talking to you.
Bye.
Have a good day. Yeah.
That is the end of this week's episode. If you'd like to get in touch, please do so by emailing me at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or message me on Instagram and Twitter @cultvaultpod. I'm your speaker, Casey, and this has been The Cult Vault.